Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my sincere blessing to be in dialogue with Chris Webb. He is an independent scholar, author, and researcher. We will be discussing his newly published book, The Sobibor Death Camp, History, Biographies, Remembrance, published by Ibidem Verlag Publishers, 2024.
Good evening. My name is Chris Webb. I'm an independent historian, researcher, and published author. And I'm going to talk to you today about the Sobibor Death Camp in Poland. The Sobibor Death Camp is located between the town of Vlodava and the city of Hel on the River Bug, northeast of Lublin in Poland. It was built as part of the Action Reinhard program, and I will now explain what Action Reinhard was. Action Reinhard was a Nazi mass murder program of Polish Jewry, which started in Lublin during March 1942. When it started in 1942, it wasn't known as Action Reinhard. It was named as Action Reinhard in June 1942 after the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, who was responsible for the final solution of the Jewish question. Dino Dobochnik named the program Action Reinhard in honour of his memory. And Adolf Eichmann confirmed in his trial in 1961 that it was named after Reinhard Heydrich. Some modern-day historians claim it was named after Fritz Reinhard, the finance minister, but it wasn't. Okay, who ran Action Reinhard? It was headed by Odilo Globocznik, the SS and police leader for the Lublin district. Globocznik was born in Trieste on April the 21st, 1904, of Austrian-Slovenian descent. He played a leading role in the Anschluss of Austria, the annexation of Austria to Germany in March 1938. He was a liaison officer, and as a result of his work for the Anschluss, he was appointed Gauleiter of Vienna, but he only held that post for a very short time because he was involved in currency speculation and he on a grand scale, and he was removed from that post and put into the lower ranks of the SS. Took part in the invasion of Poland. Himmler eventually pardoned him because Globocznik was a virulent anti-Semite, and Himmler wanted somebody like Globocznik to run Action Reinhard. I'm now going to describe the Sobibor death camp.
Please.
There were three Action Reinhard camps in Poland. The first one was Belzec, which was built in November 1941, and of which Christian Wirth was the commandant. And Belzec was the prototype and the model for Sobibor, which came later in April 1942, and Treblinka, that became operational in July 1942. The camp itself was in the form of a 400 by 600 metre rectangle, surrounded by a 3 metre high double barbed wire fence. Interwoven with pine branches, there were wooden watchtowers overlooking the camp. Was the camp divided into separate areas? Yes, it was. There were four separate areas for Sobibor. First one was the Vorlager, which contained the SS administration area and Jewish workshops and living quarters. Lager 2 Next to the Vorlager was the reception area where the deportees undressed. Lager 3 was the extermination camp, which was joined to the reception area by the so-called Tube, or Schlau in German, which was a narrow path with barbed wire on each side open at the top. You couldn't see in or out. And once you were in the Tube, and Jews were all naked, there was no escape. Into Lager 3 was the extermination camp itself, which contained the gas chamber facility, which I'll explain in more detail in a minute, and the so-called Lazarette infirmary, which I will also describe in more detail later. And the last part was Lager 4, which was built in the summer of 1943, which was a munitions supply area. Okay?
Thank you.
I am now going to describe the extermination process. The transports arrived at the ramp. These were the transports that came by rail. Most of the transports came by rail, but some also did arrive at the main gate by truck, or if they were very local, by horse-drawn carts. But sticking with the ramp, which is where most of the prisoners came to Sobibor from, the prisoners disembarked and quickly moved to Lager 2 en masse. Here they were undressed, surrendered their possessions at a special booth in the so-called Forester's House. They went through the Tube, the camouflage passageway already that I've mentioned, totally naked. The women and girls had their hair shaved in a barracks inside the Tube before entering the gas chambers. The men just went down the Tube after the women and girls straight into the gas chambers. The men's hair was not shaved off. I'm now going to describe the gas chambers. To start with, there were three gas chambers, 4 by 4 meters, with an annex for the engine that supplied the carbon monoxide gas that killed the Jewish occupants. In the autumn of 1942, new gas chambers were built at Sobibor, this time a long concrete building, 18 to 20 metres long, with 6 to 8 chambers, both with entrance doors and exit doors in each chamber that opened up like modern day garage doors, plus an engine room that housed this time 2 engines. So the chambers on either side of the gas chamber were each fed by a single petrol engine. Some say diesel, some say petrol. I think it was petrol. What happened to those killed in the gas chamber? Well, the gassing typically lasted between 20 minutes and 30 minutes. When they were sure that everyone was dead, the corpses were removed from the exit doors and they were taken and buried in mass graves. Later on, the bodies were not buried, but burned on what is the so-called roast. Now, the roasts were on a concrete base, railroad tracks were lined on top, and then the corpses stacked on the railway tracks and burnt. This was a process developed by Standartenfuhrer Paul Blobel, who was ordered by Heydrich to come up with a process to hide the bodies. The roasts, he carried out various experiments, but eventually settled on the roasts. The bodies were put onto the railroad tracks, petrol was sprayed onto them and poured onto them, and then they were set alight, then they burned. This method was so successful, it was used at Auschwitz, It was used at Belzec, it was used at Sobibor, and it was used at Treblinka. They could dispose of thousands of corpses all in one go. And it was by far and away the most efficient way of dealing with this. Remember, Belzec, Sobibor and Treblinka were primitive. They were not like Auschwitz, with its modern industrial gas chambers and crematoria brick facilities. These camps were not built to last. They were built to do a job in exterminating the Jews and then be finished with. They were not permanent arrangements, excuse me. Were there any other extermination facilities in Sobibor? Yes, there was. There was the so-called Lazarett, which in German means military hospital infirmary. This was an old pre-war chapel, and the Germans worked out they wanted to move people quickly from the tube to the gas chambers. Anybody who was ill, anybody who was crippled, would slow down the process. They didn't want that, so they separated them in Lager 2 and in Lager 1. And they were taken by tipper trucks with a railway loco and taken straight to the Lazarette, where they were shot in mass graves by Ukrainians under the control of an SS man called Paul Bredov, a particularly gruesome way of being killed. How long was Sobibor in operation for? Well, it commenced in early May 1942 and it ran until November 1943. How many Jews were murdered in Sobibor? Official estimates state that between 150,000 to 250,000 Jews were murdered in Sobibor. And Sobibor actually was the lowest. In Treblinka, nearly 900,000 were murdered. In Belzec, 450,000 were murdered. In Sobibor, let's go with the upper element, 250,000. When did transports to Sobibor from the Netherlands take place? Well, Himmler, Reichsführer SS, visited Sobibor in March 1943, and seeing that Sobibor was relatively idle, he ordered that some transports from Holland and France should be routed to Sobibor as well as Auschwitz. 19 transports left the Westerbork transit camp in Holland from March the 3rd, 1943 until July the 20th, 1943, carrying 34,313 Jews to Sobibor. Now, worth mentioning here is that for Polish Jewry, there were no transport lists. What was the point? They were going to be killed straight after arrival, the vast majority. So by and large, there were no transport lists. You won't find any. That was not the case with Westerbork. Westerbork maintained passenger lists for all the transports, for all 19 transports. So you can look at these at Westerbork Museum and you can see the names of the people that went there. And it is truly sobering to look at because you see whole families mentioned. Whole families were destroyed after a journey that lasted 3 days between Holland and Sobibor, and there were not many survivors. So in 1943, the Germans made a very, very bad mistake. They transported from Minsk camp captured Russian Jewish prisoners of war who had military experience during September 1943. One of them, the infamous Sasha Pachersky, quickly became the leader of a resistance movement along with the Jewish prisoner Leon Fellhendler, who was already at Sobibor, and they both planned a revolt. The revolt planned for the murder of individual SS officers and the prisoners breaking out of the camp via the main entrance, because the Germans had actually placed a minefield around parts of Sobibor. Therefore, the only way clear was through the main gate, but I'll talk more about that later. This revolt took place on October the 14th, 1943, and was the biggest prisoner revolt in the whole of the Second World War. Approximately 700 Jews escaped from Sobibor, some through the main gate, some didn't go through the main gate but went across the minefields, and an awful lot of them were killed doing that. The prisoner revolt started in the early afternoon, and the Russian captured prisoners of war did the actual killing. So how it worked is they invited various key SS men to try on coats, jackets. The first one was Johann Neumann, who was the deputy commandant of Sobibor. He was lured into the tailor's workshop, where he was killed with an axe and his pistol taken. Another one killed was the prisoner Joseph Wolf, who was urged to try on a jacket in one of the sorting sheds, and he was killed. And other SS men like Sepp Vallister, the Great Schutz, who was in charge of the Ukrainians, he was also lured into workshops where they were killed. Okay? In the end, I've lost the page. Bear with me.
Yes.
In the end, I'm going to consult my book now. In the end, bear with me.
Yes.
Sorry about that. Oh, I'll tell you who was killed.
Wait a minute.
Okay. Rudolf Beckmann. He was killed in the forester's house. Max Bree was killed in a sorting barracks. Friedrich Gulstich in the carpenter's workshop. Siegfried Greatschuss in the shoemaker's workshop. Fritz Conrad in the shoemaker's workshop. Johann Neumann in the tailor's workshop. Anton Novak, not known. Walter Reiber, SS garage. Thomas Steffel, forester's house. Irvin Stenglen, not known. Joseph Vallister, shoemaker's workshop. Joseph Wolf, sorting barracks. And two Travniki men were killed. Now, the Travniki men were the Ukrainian guards. I mean, I'm going to talk more about them in a minute. But Ivan Klatt was killed in the shoemaker's workshop, and Klaus Schreiber was killed by the main gate, by the escaping mob. Now, the prisoners broke out from the camp. And one of the saddest things to report is not only were they hunted by the SS and the German police and the German army and Ukrainians and Travniki men, but they were also hunted and robbed by Polish partisans, and hundreds of them were killed. Out of the 700 who broke out, hundreds of them were killed. And in the end, we've got about 100 survivors of Sobibor. I'll come on to some of those in a minute. The other key personnel of Sobibor that I ought to mention was the two commandants of Sobibor, Franz Stahl, who was an Austrian who served in the euthanasia program and was at Hartheim and other places, and Franz Karl Reinleitner also was an Austrian. He replaced Stahl when Stahl was moved to Treblinka, when Treblinka was in a state of collapse and chaos in August 1942. His place was taken by Reinleitner, who was a great friend of Stengel's. Interestingly, both Austrian, as was Ebel, the first commandant of Treblinka. He was also Austrian. So why Austrians were favoured, not known. But Stagel was a very, very, very efficient commandant. Reichleitner was less hands-on, but he was nevertheless a nasty piece of work. Other key members of the German personnel who weren't killed in the revolt, one was Karl Frenzel. They tried to kill him, but he just never took the bait. And he was one of the nastiest and cruel SS men of Sobibor. And after the war, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Another famous member of the SS Sonderkommando Sobibor was Gustav Wallner, another Austrian who was actually on leave when the revolt took place. Another key member was Hubert Gamerski. He was also a veteran of T4. He was also on leave at the time of the revolt. And other SS men worth mentioning are Erich Bauer, the so-called Gasmeister, who was in charge of the gas chambers at Sobibor. He was there in Sobibor, but was not killed. Rudolf Beckmann, who was in charge of the administration and also the stables at Sobibor, he was killed. And Johann Neumann, the deputy commandant, who also served at Belzec, he was killed. And another one, Paul Grote, who was also at Belzec, he was transferred out of Sobibor, allegedly because of a relationship with a Jewish prisoner, an actress, he went to Belzec. Now, obviously, we know so much about Sobibor because some of the Jewish inmates survived. And I'm not going to list them all. There's about 100. One of the most famous is Thomas Toivy Blatt, who survived. He came from Itzbeka in April 1943. He survived, settled in America, and has written two books about Sobibor, which I very much recommend. They're very, very well worth reading. Another one was Stanislav Smashner, who was a goldsmith. And he survived by making jewellery for the SS. He also wrote a book. Unfortunately, he settled in Brazil and wrote a book in Portuguese. Leon Fellhändler, who was from Zolkiev in the Lublin district, he was a member of the Judenrat in Zolkiev. His father was a rabbi. He survived Sobibor. He escaped from Sobibor. He survived living in the forest, settled in Lublin, but shortly after the war, he was murdered in Lublin by Polish anti-Semites. So great, great shame that he led them out of the death camp, but didn't survive. And Sasha Pachersky, the Soviet prisoner of war who masterminded the revolt, he survived and, along with a lot of his men, managed to cross the River Bug and get back into Soviet territory where he joined the partisans. And he survived and lived a long life. Passed away, I think, in 19, I'll tell you, passed away when, worse. Here we go. Chersky passed away on January the 19th, 1990, in Rostov on the Don. Another Jewish prisoner worthy of mention was a Dutch Jew called Jules Schelvis. He was deported from Westerbork to Sobibor on June the 1st, 1943, along with his wife and members of her family. His wife, Rachel, she was murdered on arrival. He managed. They were separated, as they all were always separated. He said he didn't even realise that she'd gone when he was no longer by her side. He was selected by the SS for work in an outside labour camp near Sobibor called Dorohutsa. And so his time in Sobibor was just a few hours. But he went to Dorohutsa and other places, and he survived the war and lived in Holland. And he also wrote an excellent book on Sobibor, which I have, of course, and which I used. But bearing in mind, his time there was limited. Okay? So those books are also worth buying. They tell you everything about Sobibor in great detail. I sense in some respects, Blatt's are the better books because he was there. So if that makes sense. So what is the theme? Make sure I got the right questions then. Okay. Right. What's the key theme of my new book on Sobibor? Let me show it to you. Hope you can see it. Can you see it?
Thank you.
And you see it's quite a big book.
Thank you, yes.
Okay. That was published by Ibidem on January the 15th, 2024. But the theme of this book, which I want to go into in some detail, is it's a second edition, so it contains a lot of information contained in the first edition. But what's new in the second edition is the post-war testimony of various SS men, including Erich Bauer and Karl Frenzel and Gomersky. So all the key players, they were interrogated by the German authorities over a number of years, and their testimonies or their evidence that they gave was recorded in German. Now, what is strikingly obvious is, one, how they all tried to limit their involvement. Erich Bauer, who was in charge of the gas chambers, as an example, said, "I never saw the inside of a gas chamber." That's a lie. And they also minimised the number of transports. They also minimised the number of Jews killed. They would blame others for what they did. Erich Lambert, who helped build the new gas chambers in the autumn of 1943, actually stated at the end of his evidence that in Sobibor he never did anything to hurt the Jews. Well, how can this be so? He built the gas chamber that killed them. So most of them either lied through their teeth about what they did, or they blamed others that were no longer alive, or they tried in some way to limit their own guilt. That comes across in almost every testimony. Maybe that's a natural thing to do. Prisoners don't give anything away, those guilty. But generally speaking, that I find quite an amazing fact. Now, for example, Gustav Wagner actually died in 1978. Most of these interrogations took place after the war, during the 50s and 60s, leading up to a trial in 1966 for the Sobibor garrison. Now, at the Sobibor, so have I got across that the theme of the book is these post-war testimonies, which are actually, they don't deny they were there. They don't deny they were in Sobibor, but they do try and deny the scale of their crimes. I never saw anything. I never did anything. I never hurt anybody. Loads of them say that. And it's just plainly not true. So I'm going to just come across the trial, give you a bit of info on the trial itself. Bear with me. Should have prepared this better, but gives me a little break.
Thank you.
Bear with me. Right, okay. Carl Frenzel was found guilty of war crimes. I'll tell you what it is, isn't it? Right. The trial took place in Hagen, then West Germany, and began on September the 6th, 1965. So all those testimonies were building up to the trial. Frenzel got life imprisonment. Franz Wolf, 8 years in prison. Alfred Ittner, 4 years in prison. Werner Dubois, 3 years in prison. Eric Fuchs, 4 years in prison. Eric Lachman, who was in charge of the Travniki men, and I'm going to talk more about them in a minute, he was acquitted. Heinz Hans Schutt was also acquitted. Heinrich Unverhau was acquitted. Robert Jers was acquitted. Ernest Zirk was acquitted. Erwin Lambert, who built the gas chambers, was acquitted. And Kurt Belender, who was in charge of the extermination camp, he committed suicide before sentencing. So not many were actually given prison sentences, which is pretty dreadful. Now, in terms of the Travniki men, the SS could not have carried out Action Reinhold without the help and support of the so-called Travniki Manor. They got that name because they were trained at a special SS camp in Travniki, which is 25 miles from Lublin, at this special training camp. Generally speaking, there were usually, in terms of the SS garrison, about 30 SS men at any given time in Sobibor, Treblinka and Belzec. The rest of the guard duties, so the ordinary guard duties, manning the watchtowers, supervising the workers, guarding the workers, were done by 120 mainly Ukrainian Soviet prisoners of war trained at Travniki, hence the name Travniki Manor. Now, one of the most famous Travniki Manor was John Ivan Emanuk, who was extradited to Israel in 1986 to stand trial as the supposed Ivan the Terrible, who was in charge of the Treblinka gas chambers. Now, it was already known, certainly to the Americans and the Russians, that Ivan the Terrible was in fact Ivan Marchenko, also from the Ukraine. Demanyuk was never in Treblinka. Demanyuk was in Sobibor. They produced a Travniki Manor identity card, which showed that he went to a labour camp in the Lublin area, but also Sobibor. And eventually, after being released from Israel on appeal, was sentenced to death, clearly on a case of mistaken identity, he went back to America. He was extradited from America to Germany, to Bonn, where he stood trial for being a guard at Sobibor. He was found guilty of war crimes and he was sentenced to prison. However, Demjanjuk appealed against that ruling and Demjanjuk was placed in a nursing home, and pending an appeal, he passed away. Legally, in Germany, when you pass away under an appeal, you are a free man. You are not guilty. So Demjanjuk, even though obviously he was a war criminal, ended up being declared a free man as a result of him passing away in the nursing home. So in terms of Sobibor, I hope that I've covered a lot to take in, and I hope that I did it justice. and I hope that you found it useful.
Thank you so much. I'm truly grateful.
I mean, I'm going to then say that's the theme of my book that I showed you. A little bit of plugging there. Where can you buy it? It can be bought online by Amazon and other reputable bookstores like Waterstones and things like that in England. But Amazon definitely do stock it. What am I doing now? Well, never stop, as you know. I'm currently 99.9% finished on a new book on Treblinka. Dealing with the heart of that is the trial of Fyodor Fedorenko, a Travniki manor who settled in the US after the war. At his denaturalization hearing, he won that originally, but then lost on appeal. He was extradited to Russia, where he was executed by firing squad in 1986. So that's what I'm currently working on. To finish that book, I have to go to Berlin to visit an archivist, of which I'm going in March. So I hope to finish the book around about August, September time after my visit to Germany, Berlin. So that's what I'm doing. That will also be published by Ibidem Verlag, who are my publishers based in Germany. It's in English, but the book is published in Germany. And I now throw the floor open to you for any questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Can you tell us about the Sobibor trial of 1965 and 66?
Well, I did cover that a bit. Most of them were acquitted. Let's have a look. Let's see if I can give you any other sort of details that I haven't covered. Bear with me. Quite a number of Jews gave evidence at the trial. I don't really know whether there's much to say. When Stengel, well, I'll tell you a bit about this. Only one member of the Sobibor garrison, Werner Dubois, admitted guilt in his court testimony. He said, "It is clear to me that in the extermination camp, murder was committed. What I have done was only to assist in that murder. If I were to be found guilty, it would be justified. Murder is murder. We are all guilty. The camp had a chain of command, and if one link in the chain were to refuse to cooperate, then the whole system would collapse. We did not have the courage to disobey orders." Most of the others, in their defence, cited one man that they were in fear of, and that wasn't the commandant. That was Christian Wirth. He was also involved in the construction of Sobibor. He was the commandant of Belzec. He became inspector of the SS Sonderkommando for Action Reinhold, based in Lublin, appointed by Globochnik on August the 1st. Wirth ruled all of these camps with a rod of iron, and a lot of people were very, very scared of him. A lot of the SS men were very scared of him. And a lot of them cited being scared of Christian Wirth as to why they carried out the orders. So that's worthy of mention, I think. Given the number of acquittals, it would appear that the judges were swayed by the defence. It could be claimed that by 1966, the world had grown weary about the Holocaust, and the passage of time had somehow lessened the enormity of the crimes committed there. Now, Smashner, who survived Sobibor. He was a young boy, by the way, but he was 13 when he went to Sobibor. He actually testified at the Stengel trial in Dusseldorf about Treblinka. Stengel was never faced justice for his time in Sobibor, just Treblinka. So why that was, I suppose it's a bit like if someone's charged for multiple murders in now, they don't necessarily they indict them for a few and then tag on the rest. So I guess that's what happened there. In terms of the trials, it's not really, I don't go into trials. Some people do. I don't. I just say what they were charged with, what they were sentenced for, and a bit of background. Beth, any other questions?
Can you tell us about the Sobibor prisoner uprising? What specifically occurred?
Okay. What happened is that Pacharsky devised a plan that they would kill individual SS men. And by and large, that was the plan that was carried out. And the killings were all done by some Jews helping the Soviet prisoners of war. Most of the SS men were led to locations out of the way and then quietly assassinated, usually with a blow to the back of the head with an axe. Beckmann, who was a key member of Sobibor, Beckmann was killed by the prisoner Heim Engel, Polish prisoner Heim Engel, with a knife in Beckmann's own office, with the help of Capo Orczyski. Particularly brutal killing of Beckmann, and also in the forest itself, Stengel was also killed by a knife. Most of the others were killed by blows from an axe carried out by, and let me just go into this for you, give you some names of who killed, who took part in the killing. Some of the people who carried out the killings. Right. As I said, Beckmann was killed by Engel and Capo Hertz Orzicki. Gulstich was killed by Shlomo Lightman. Greitschutz was killed by Arkady Weiss-Papier and Yehuda Lerner. Lyman was killed by Alexander Shubaev and Yehuda Lerner. Walter Reiber, who was killed in the SS garage, was a random killing, and he was killed by Engel, the Jewish locksmith Engel. And that worried Pacharsky the most. He was killed in the SS garage, which was near the SS quarters. The killing wasn't planned. It was ad hoc. And Pacharsky was worried that the SS would discover the body early and discover the revolt. That's why they then went a little bit early. Thomas Steffel, Heim Engel and Hirsch Borzicki, Joseph Wolf was killed by Boris Cebulski, also another Soviet prisoner of war. Ivan Klatt, the Treblinka Manor, he was head guard of the Treblinka Manor, was killed by Chaskil Mensch, Eskardi Weisspaper, and Yehuda Lerner. And Klaus Schreiber, who was killed by the main gate, was killed by the escaping mob. So the revolt was extremely well planned, almost like clockwork. Smyshner was able also to visit the Ukrainian forces and was able to steal some rifles that he brought back to the organizers and the Russian POWs. So that was extremely helpful that he did that. So he also played a leading role in the revolt. So after killing the SS individually and having worked out that at least a third of the SS men were killed, Pechersky then got all the prisoners assembled early in the main square, got on a table and said, "Escape." They blew a bugle was blown to call the Jews for roll call. So they all gathered. And once they all gathered, he said, "Right, run." Some ran to the main gate. Some ran to the fences, where they got over the fences, crossed the minefield, into the forest, and safety, relative safety. And obviously the Germans were stunned at first and didn't respond, but then, of course, started to open fire from the watchtowers, and they killed hundreds of prisoners in the revolt. Okay?
Thank you.
Anything else?
What, if anything, was unique about Sobibor vis-a-vis other concentration camps and death camps?
If I was to pick out one thing, I would say, by and large, it's that people did cross the threshold and were moved out very quickly to other labour camps. Didn't happen in Belzec. Didn't happen in Treblinka. It might have happened to Treblinka on the odd transport, but much more from Sobibor. What was unusual? Well, the methods of killing and the outlier of the camp, they were all very similar. One thing that was a bit different, I suppose, is the Sobibor train station, where transports pulled up to. The station was just outside the camp. The Treblinka station was about 4 kilometres from the camp. So the station played a more integral part of the... when transports arrived, usually transports were 60 cars long. They were split up, and in Sobibor, the ramp wasn't as big as the ramp in Treblinka, and the Sobibor ramp could only accommodate 11 carriages and the locomotives, and they were pushed onto the ramp. Also in Treblinka, they were also pushed into the ramp. The Treblinka ramp could hold 20 freight cars and a locomotive, Sobibor 11. So you've got passenger trains passing through Sobibor station. They could see the outside of the camp and they could see the watchtowers, but they couldn't see inside because of the outer fencing was all covered with pine leaves, interwoven with thick pine leaves, so you couldn't see inside. But ordinary passenger transports did pass by the camp. That's quite unusual, okay? But the murder process was defined, was established by Christian Witt in Trial and Error in Belzec. Once he had established something, that was it. That was the prescribed method. Stengel and Reichleitner followed that out religiously, even after Witt was no longer on the scene. So in the death camps, process was the same. Concentration camps, totally different. Concentration camps, even like Auschwitz, had a dual function between forced labour and extermination. In Treblinka, Sobibor and Belzec, there was just extermination. Those that were kept alive to service the death camp, nothing else. I mean, there was another escape in July 1943 that I was ought to mention, is that members of the Vold Commando, that's the commando that worked in the forest, they also had a mini breakout, and quite a number of prisoners escaped then, but nothing on the scale of the prisoner revolt on October the 14th. So on October the 14th, the main aim was get out of the camp, cross the minefields, Lord Mayne, get into the forest and join the partisans in the forest. That was their aim and that was their goal. Okay?
Thank you.
Anything else?
Can you comment on the role of capos in the Sobibor camp?
Yes. Yeah. The Germans introduced capos in all camps, including concentration camps, to oversee prisoner commandos and to mete out discipline. And in Sobibor, there was an Oberkapo who was in charge of the whole of the capos, and his name was Moshe Sturm, but Sturm, Polish Jew, but Sturm planned to escape, and Sturm was betrayed by capo, Herbert Nathaniel, who was known as Berliner, because he came from Berlin. He was betrayed by him, and Berliner became the Oberkapo. Pachevsky realized that the Oberkapo, Berliner, was dangerous, and he arranged for a number of Jewish prisoners, including Smajner and a few others. They ambushed Berliner, got him into a barrack, and beat him with their fists nearly to death. Eventually, they reported to Frenzel that Berliner was very sick, and Berliner said he wanted him finished. And they fed him a poisoned meal and did away with him. Capos, Oberkapos and capos, very important is that, by and large, they oversaw on a day-to-day basis the Jewish workers in commandos, and they whipped, they flogged Jewish commandos who had committed transgression or not worked. So the SS got them to do their dirty work for them. The SS also carried out beatings, but a lot of the beatings were carried out by capos. They had a whip. They had a uniform. I should say this about Sobibor. By and large, in all the three death camps, they did not wear a prisoner uniform. They wore their own normal civilian clothes. That may be hard to believe, but that is a fact. What was the point of issuing with uniforms? They weren't going to live very long. That's the Nazi thinking. So the capos maintained discipline, but some of the capos did help the Jews in the revolt. Most of them lost their lives during the revolt. The prisoners that didn't escape from Sobibor, they were prisoners that, for whatever reason, weren't able to escape. They were all killed straight away after the revolt. And the SS brought in SS men from Treblinka to replace those that had been killed. And they also transported in Jewish prisoners from Treblinka to begin the dismantling of the camp. And I ought to say this, in November 1943. At the end of November, or towards the end of November, when all facilities have been destroyed, or the gas chambers have been destroyed, a lot of the barracks stayed. They were not destroyed. The prisoners were killed by Gustav Wagner and others on one day. They were all killed, and the camp was liquidated. And the camp closed down in 19th of November, 1943. And with the closure of Sobibor, that marked the end of Action Reinhard. That was it. It finished. And the German, and a lot of the Germans and some of the Trebniki men went to Italy, where they either were killed in action or saw out the end of the war when they were captured by the Allies. So that was good, actually. That it was good that you made me do that, because I was able to give you more information. Okay?
Thank you. Can you elaborate on the origins and creation of the Sobibor camp?
Right. Well, briefly, the Germans had a plan to kill Polish Jewry, which there were about 3 million of them, I think. So they divided the areas up. So Krakow, Lublin, Lwów went to Belzec. Sobibor was also considered an overflow camp of Bilsich. So you also got from Sobibor, mainly the Lublin district went there, and Lublin district is very large. And in the Warsaw district, and Częstochowa, and Radom, and Kielce, and Białystok, places like that, went to Treblinka. So they built these camps primarily to cater for the catchment areas of the areas that I've just described. And they started building Sobibor in the spring of 1942, and by May 1942, it was ready. Treblinka was the biggest. Sobibor, I said, was probably the medium-sized camp. The areas located, picked, is important. Sparsely populated for all three. In the case of Sobibor, deep, deep in densely wooded forest, remote, no people, escape difficult. Treblinka, similar, not quite so dense forest, but there were forests there. Good railway links. There had to be good railway links for all three of the detachments. So that primarily was why they were built. Stengel said he was never told he was going to head a death camp by Klobuchnik. I don't believe him. That's what he said, I don't believe. And Stengel visited via Bilsich to see what went on at Bilsich, and didn't like what he saw, but then he knew what he was going to do at Sobibor. In terms of the origin, so basically they were built not to last. They were primitive wooden buildings. The only concrete buildings in them were the gas chambers. And amazingly, all three camps, Bilsich, Sobibor, and Treblinka, the original gas chamber facilities were deemed inadequate and had to be replaced by bigger facilities. In all three camps, that was the case. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Last question.
Can you tell us about your personal visits to Sobibor? What impact did the site have on you and make on you?
Yeah, that's a good question to end on. I've been to all three sites. I've been to Sobibor twice. In the early, in 2002, 2004. What strikes you most about Sobibor is its remoteness, the dense forests, the feeling that actually you really are at the back of beyond. And there's something still to this day, particularly at Sobibor, that makes you realise that something horrible went on there. And I got that most at Sobibor. Now, there's a new museum there, which is supposed to be a fine museum. There's been some archaeological work, which uncovered the number of gas chambers recently in the last few years. I haven't been there since 2004. There was a huge watchtower, Forester's Tower, that dominated the site. Well, in 2004, when I last visited, I saw it in 2002. In 2004, it had gone. It had blown down. So it was no longer there anymore. So the ramp is still there. The buffer is still there, where the drains went. The commandant's villa is still there, and maybe one or two other buildings. Now, at Bilsich and Sobibor, when the camps closed, they destroyed all the barracks. They didn't do that in Sobibor. They destroyed some, but not all. And those barracks were still there, used by the Baudins, the German construction service, until 1944, when obviously they were abandoned the site and the Soviets liberated the site. A lot of the barracks were still there. Sobibor was used as a holding area for Soviets, members of the Soviet Union, going back to the Soviet Union. Don't forget, the Ukrainian border is only about 5 kilometres away. And a lot of those barracks were torn down to be used as firewood. So they were destroyed by the Russians, not the Germans. And the station is still there, although trains no longer run there. Normal passenger trains don't run there anymore. That's the same at Treblinka. So there you are. That's my overriding feeling. It is a place of horror, and I was very moved by it. I'm moved by all of these sites, but Sobibor in particular affected me the most.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, I'd like to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your thoughtfulness, eloquence, erudition, and wisdom that you shared with us today. Thank you for all the preparation that you invested in this project.
You are very welcome. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. As we end today, I'm signing off as Ari Barbalat, your host in the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. Today, I've been in dialogue with Chris Webb regarding his newly published book, The Sobibor Death Camp, History's Biographies, Remembrance, published by Ibidem Verlag Publishers, 2024.